Gene was universally liked. He just was one of those people whom everybody was fond of, and maybe his parents were right. Maybe he should have become a priest, but he initiated the priesthood of jazz drumming, so that was his way.
Hi, I'm Stuart Copeland, and this is part two of the story of Gene Krupa, Drumming Man, bringing you first that sound from the depths of the Great Depression in 1932 when the recording industry almost collapsed. But somehow records like that kept getting made with a mixed band of black and white Americans and our man Gene Krupa thrashing away at the drums.
Those were the years in between when the Chicago guys were young and feisty and were working in the worst kind of speakeasies, and before the big bands came through, and they were lucky to get work at all, and very lucky if they could find work that had any jazz content.
Jazz critic and historian Gary Giddens. Krupa got through those years in totally commercial bands. The last one, a vanity project led by movie star Buddy Rogers, who liked to think he could play a lot of instruments. One night, in 1934, he happened to be playing them even worse than usual when an offer came in from Krupa's old friend and fellow Chicagoan, Benny Goodman. Gene liked the money Rogers paid, but the music was terrible, so he gave in his notice. It was the best news that Goodman had had in some time.
If we listen to this stuff that he recorded with Sammy Weiss on drums and so on, and then Krupa comes in, makes a huge difference. Makes a tremendous difference. He really infused the band with something that it hadn't had before.
Professor Dan Morgenstern of the Institute for Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. We can test out this statement easily. Here's the last recording drummer Sammy Weiss made with Goodman's band late in 1934. It was called Music Hall Rag. Not to be too hard on Sammy Weiss, it was okay in a hustling circus style, but when you compare it to the personality drumming Krupa brought to Goodman, once he'd settled in, that new uplift is really obvious. Not just Benny Goodman to back up, but Bunny Berrigan on trumpet, too. If Gene's sound and his athleticism had been the only assets he brought to Benny's band, that would have been fine, but there was more. For almost the first time in jazz, the looks of the guy, on stage and off, began to be a factor in his reputation.
Gene looked like a film star. He apparently had studied drums with someone who encouraged him to play from the shoulders, and so that sort of gave him a more exciting look, as though he was sort of hulking over the drums. He chewed gum. He had the kind of hair that sort of, you know, naturally falls over your forehead. He just had all of these charismatic qualities when he played, and he brought the drums from the back of the stage, from the well-behaved gentility of just keeping time, to being a kind of a sometimes bombastic, but very often exciting star of the band, much to Benny Goodman's chagrin, but that's another story.
Yes, the friction would come later. In terms of the drum technique that Krupa revealed with Goodman, nothing wildly complicated was attempted. And yet, there were some things about Gene's technique that are still debated. For example, we drummers have this thing called the ride cymbal. It's not used to make surprise crashes and big accents, but to sustain a steady shimmering beat through a chorus. But who used it first in the recording studio? Well, according to British drummer Richard Pite, Gene Krupa must be a strong candidate.
Looking at my research, Krupa was the first person ever to use ride cymbal on a recording. He used it in China Boy with Jack Teagarden and Red Nichols back in 1930. And he went through a little phase of using it, just a little period where he had the cymbal, he obviously liked the sound of it. The recording to me, which is most poignant, is the one that he did with Big Spiderbeck, right at the end of Spiderbeck's career. It's called Deep Down South, and it came out on 78. On the other side was I'll Be a Friend with Pleasure. And on both Big solos, he accompanies him on ride cymbal.
Joining in with I'll Be a Friend with Pleasure at the end of the terrible vocal, we can hear that happening. May not be the first recording of it, but that's the ride cymbal style, all right. Once Gene had joined the Goodman Swing Band, most of his work was done under Benny's name. But there were exceptions, including some less formal blowing sessions of the kind Gene always liked.
Oddball record sessions like the two first record sessions that he made under his own name.
Lauren Schoenberg, executive director of the Jazz Museum in Harlem.
In the winter of 1935 and 36, when the Goodman Band was in Chicago, for an extended run, really their first extended, tremendously popular engagement after their initial breakthrough on the West Coast, was in Chicago at the Joseph Urban Room of the Congress Hotel. And during that gig, Gene made a record session for England, for English Parlophone, produced by John Hammond. Then, just weeks later, they made another record date with the front line from Fletcher Henderson's band, with Roy Eldridge on trumpet and Chu Berry on the tenor. Now, this was as hot and as modern as jazz got in 1936.
He's wonderfully exciting on those, and everybody is playing for the purpose of creating excitement, and so he's the right guy there. You know, you don't look to Gene for subtlety. That's not what he's about.
Gary Giddens. The track we heard was called I Hope Gabriel Likes My Music. By the way, the idea that Gene didn't go in for subtlety shouldn't be taken to mean that he was always loud.
He could also play great brushes, you know, and the work he did with the Goodman Trio should not be ignored, because that small group stuff also caught the attention of listeners and of other drummers.
The Goodman Trio and the Goodman Quartet, those records are wonderful. I love them. I think that, Teddy rarely played better than on those records. Benny really kept a relatively low and certainly disciplined profile.
The Goodman Quartet, with Benny himself and Krupa representing white America, Teddy Wilson and Lionel Hampton, the black tradition. Looks like a bold step on Benny's part, but he was really just putting sounds together. Of the two white players, the one with the strong feelings on those matters was Krupa.
It was absolutely Krupa, and Krupa took the next step. I mean, he went beyond Benny. You know, he really was colorblind. Except that he wasn't to the degree that he also felt strongly that this was a statement you have to make.
Made Benny fly.
Jazz broadcaster Jeffrey Smith.
I mean, he was always Benny's favorite drummer. You know, even after he died, Benny was looking back on his career and they said, well, who's your favorite drummer? And he said, oh, it was always Gene Krupa, you know. And despite the fact, you know, they had their problems, who did Benny not have problems with? That bond was never lost.
I know there are people who say that Krupa's time wasn't that great and so on. I think that's a lot of bull. His time is different from that of some other drummers. You know, we all loved what Joe Jones did with Basie, and Cozy Cole was wonderful. But Gene had his own thing, and he certainly had a great beat. I mean, that was his great time that got all the dancers out and that made him so popular during the swing era.
Dan Morgenstern. The great modern drummer Ed Shaughnessy is even more emphatic about it.
He wouldn't have been as successful as he was if he didn't have good tempo. Any drummer has to have good tempo, otherwise you don't last in the business. Besides, listen to the records, you know. It's silly. I like things like Roll'em, where he played snare drum throughout. That was a great example of great press rolling throughout the piece called Roll'em. I'm very partial to that because it shows that type of technique off so very well. But I like everything he did. You know, it's hard for me to pick out special ones.
Naturally, Krupa's fame with the Goodman Band was commercially exploitable. Again, nothing like it had happened in jazz before. The Slingland Company's drums had only been on the market since 1928, but Gene made them seem all-American in a permanent kind of way. Even the way he positioned the drums was definitive.
You can't say the name Slingerland without thinking about Krupa. Yeah, I think that those ads were very influential because they had a photograph of the setup. People went to see the setup, white kids especially who wanted drum sets. I mean, how did you learn? You learn by imitating, and Krupa's setup was the one.
And this guy basically turned around and said, I think you set it up this way. Tom-tom in front, a tom-tom on the floor, ride cymbal directly in front of your right hand, if you're right-handed. Before you know it, ergonomically, perfect. It works. And we're still using that setup today. So, yeah, I have to take my hat off to him. As we know, I'm not the greatest player, but what an innovator. This guy was making adverts. He was selling aspirins. You know, there's a poster which says, Gene Krupa takes, and they'll name the product after he plays. And you think, hang on a minute. And then you see the Slingerland drums on the film. Here is product placement. Here is a man who's doing everything that people do today. And we think it's new. He was doing it way back when.
Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Of course, none of this could last. Benny Goodman's aim in setting up his band had never been to make his drummer famous. And bad feelings did arise over the kind of adulation Gene was provoking. Not to mention the drum solos that the crowds now expected of him. One of Goodman's band's most famous triumphs, its first Carnegie Hall concert on January 16, 1938, was also a crisis point in the story of Benny and Gene.
You know, there's the famous comment, isn't there, by Harry James before they went on, and when he's in the wings, he says, I feel like a whore in church, just before they went on. So yes, they were intimidated by it. And I think it's very easy to forget now that kind of lowly status of jazz musicians back then. You kind of get the feeling that Krupa wasn't two-faced by it, and he just wanted to go for it. And there is that wonderful moment in Don't Be That Way where the band is chugging along and the drum break happens, and it's the most extraordinary drum break. And it does, it gets a fantastic response from the audience straight away. So right from the outset, within a minute, Krupa had probably really knocked Goodman, which, you know, is another point for him, I think. Very pleased with that. And it's the most ridiculous break as well, and very, very exciting. And not that difficult to do.
There were two shots registered in that number, both of them by Gene, and you heard the reaction. The most discussed tune played that night was the extended feature called Sing, Sing, Sing.
It had started in 1936 as just a commercial arrangement of a popular tune by Louis Prima, and then, according to what I've read, when the band was done playing the arrangement, Krupa went into a tom-tom beat, and the band kind of started to ad-lib these various backgrounds and solos, and they were eventually put together by the arranger Jimmy Mundy, and then it became such a big hit. But certainly all kinds of drummers, Ray Baduke and Ben Pollock and Lord knows how many others, were all doing tom-tom things. I think in a way almost become an albatross around Krupa's neck at one point.
It certainly did. When Count Basie's great drummer Joe Jones made a reminiscent album about other drummer styles, the tom-tom thing was all he cared to talk about. And he was a friend of Krupa's.
Now we move up to modern times. And that was a fella that came around that studied for the priesthood. He only played one beat. And it was a very simple beat. Now, all he did was this.
As all good jazz historians know, the performance of Sing, Sing, Sing that night wasn't a triumph for either Benny or Gene. It was stolen by an inspired meditation from Jess Stacy at the piano. And yet, the part of the number that everybody knows and can reproduce is Gene's tom-tom display.
People love it. And to play Sing, Sing, Sing is not that demanding, technically, not at all. But the very satisfying thing about it is that the reaction that it gets, compared to other far more technical solos, you know that if you just go down to the basics and keep those bass drum beats going and the triplets firing and simple crashes and rim shots, you're going to win. He knew that. That's why he did it for years and years.
But not in the Goodman Band. What happened at Carnegie Hall was actually the beginning of a sudden end, which only few saw coming.
Russ Conner, who was the dean of all Goodman biographers and writers, wrote that he remembered seeing the band in Philadelphia, and the crowd was going nuts, you know, demanding that Krupa play a solo. And Krupa, you know, I guess held his drumsticks up in the air and pointed to Goodman and, you know, gestured, "He won't let me."
Once you see that kind of thing on stage, the end can't be far away.
2 weeks later, I think. And it was simply about this issue. I mean, Goodman was, as most people know, was a very, very difficult individual. And one thing that he could not tolerate. And it must have been a difficult dilemma for him, because his band was riding at its highest at that point. And yet he had people like Harry James and Krupa who were constantly stealing the limelight from him. But he realized that was the price he had to pay for the stardom that he was getting.
Krupa stormed off, and they got Lionel Hampton for a while, which is a pretty good replacement. And then in a couple of months, Gene had his own band, which is a pretty quick turnaround time for getting a band together.
It was very quick. But the guys coming into the band knew it would be no hardship working for Gene.
I mean, when Benny Goodman died, I was in a rehearsal with the American Jazz Orchestra, and two-thirds of the guys in the band had played with Benny, and they immediately, as soon as the news came in, started telling anecdotes that were so unflattering, so filled with anger, and, you know, and then they would say, yes, but of course he was an incredible musician, he was the greatest clarinetist, he was this and that, but they really hated him, whereas with Gene, I don't ever remember anybody saying an unkind word about that guy.
With Lionel Hampton at the vibraphone joining the Goodman Trio, the Goodman Quartet give us their version of Avalon.
Quartet, broadcasting from the Manhattan room of the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. I'll let them take it on out. How Gene's own band fared, and there were spectacular ups and downs, we'll hear next time. I'm Stuart Copeland, and this is Gene Krupa, Drumming Man. A Ping production for Radio 2, written by Russell Davies and produced by Graham Pass.